An assistant city solicitor for Philadelphia's law department in the major tax unit is a long way from the poor neighborhood in Detroit where she was born. Her mother was a single parent who had problems with drugs and alcohol. They were homeless for a period of time. Nikki went to live with her grandmother, whom she credits with helping her believe in herself and helping her to aim high. She had a rude awakening when she was a freshman at St. Joseph's University outside of Philadelphia when she failed out. She was hired as a nanny for a couple on the main line, graduated from St. Joe's, and went on to get three degrees from Temple University Law School. We frankly found Nikki Johnson Houston's story inspiring, and we asked her to join us on Radio Times, and she's sitting across from me. And Nikki, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you think of your story, your life, as inspiring?
I think of it as just being my story. I feel very fortunate and lucky, and I think it makes me feel an obligation to share with others the possibilities in their own lives.
Lucky how?
I think I've seen in my own life, my brother unfortunately wasn't able to make it out of poverty. He passed away a couple of years ago. So in my own personal life, I know that so many people who live in poverty, who've been homeless like I was, they have a lot of dreams and hopes for themselves, but life gets in the way, and sometimes they make bad decisions and they have some bad breaks and they're not able to make it out. And so I like to think of myself as being a voice for the voiceless.
Well, I want to talk about your life because you grew up in Detroit.
Yes, I did.
Your mom was a single mom.
She was.
And your family was poor.
We were very poor. I like to say that, unfortunately, I think I was born into a situation like a lot of people who live in the cities in this country. By the time I was 5 years old, two of my uncles had been brutally murdered on the streets of Detroit. My dad wasn't around. He left when I was about 2 years old. And, my mother had drug and alcohol issues. And really the glue that held us together was my maternal grandmother, who worked as a domestic for her life. And she really grounded me. But when I was five, she was in a pretty terrible bus accident coming home from one of her jobs, and it disabled her. And so that really changed our family. And my grandmother got a small settlement, and she made the decision that she was going to get our family out of Detroit because she was really concerned for our safety. And that's actually how we moved to California.
And lived in San Diego area?
Originally, we lived in Central California by Santa Barbara, which is a lovely area, but very expensive. The way we ended up getting to San Diego was, even though we moved to California, my mom's issues came with us, unfortunately. And after a lot of conflict, she decided that she was going to move away from my grandmother and moved us down to San Diego. But she really didn't have a plan. And after about a month of being there, she met a man, and he basically took all of our money. And we were living in a hotel, and then we went down to living in a motel to, if people were kind enough to let us sleep on a sofa or, on a floor, or loan us a car. And then we ran out of friends. And that's how we ended up on the streets.
And when you say your mom's issues, we're talking about her issues, her problems with drugs and alcohol?
Yes, drugs. Absolutely an alcoholic, drug problems. It made it very difficult for her to, get up and go to work. She didn't consistently work, even though she was a very intelligent person. And I think that's the frustrating thing, is my mom was talented, and a lot of the people that I grew up with were talented. But I think along the way, they lost the hope of what was possible for them, and they really got caught up. And so after that, we were on the streets, and we would stand in line and try to wait for a room in a shelter, a bed. And if they ran out of beds, then we didn't have any place to go for the night.
So where would you go?
Where would you sleep? My mom would find a park bench, and she would sleep with her eyes open, and she would put one of us on each of her knee. So my head would be on one knee, and my brother's head would be on the other. And she would stay like that all night.
And how old were you at the time?
I was nine. And it's just such a scary time being a child. You don't know what's going on, but you know it's not the way it's supposed to be. But out of that darkness came an opportunity, which was during the day, we didn't have any place to go. So the shelters were only available for us at night. So we would go to the library. And I like to say that the books became my friends and playmates. And I started reading about the bigger world, the larger world, reading about biographies of people who had been through difficult times and had made it out the other side. And it helped me to dream and to conceive of a better future. And I'll always be thankful for that.
Well, it's so interesting because here you were, I mean, your real life, obviously so difficult, but here these books showing you another world.
Yes.
And what you believe that world was something that you could have.
Absolutely. I think I definitely, once I went to live with my grandmother, and what I will say about my mother is that she made a very selfless decision, that she realized that she couldn't keep us together as a family, and she decided to split us up. And I know that was very difficult for her, and she still has alcohol issues, but I'm very proud to say that she's been off drugs for about 25 years. So I'm thankful for that. But because we were split up as a family, the decision was made for me to go live with my disabled grandmother. My grandmother could only take one of us, and it was twofold. One, she was living in Section 8 housing for senior citizens, so she wasn't actually supposed to have any of us. And two, my brother had some behavioral issues, which you can imagine from sort of the circumstances
Sure.
we grew up in.
Sure.
And he was very traumatized, and I think he probably would have been diagnosed as ADHD. But we just didn't really know about that back then. And I think because I was a girl, it's very dangerous being out on the streets. The decision was made to send me to my grandmother. And I remember getting off the – I was put on a Greyhound bus, and I remember getting off the Greyhound bus.
And you're about 9 years old at the time?
Yes. I just turned 10. I remember getting off the Greyhound bus. It's 11:45 at night. It's dark, and I see my grandmother waiting there for me. And I get off the bus, and she says to me, "You're fortunate enough to be born in a different America than the America I was born to." And she said, "You are fortunate enough to be born to the greatest generation of women that will have ever lived. What are you going to do with that?"
This is the first thing she said to you.
That's the first thing she said to me. And to give you a context for that is my grandmother worked her whole life as a domestic. She grew up in Mississippi under Jim Crow. She was the last of 14 kids. She had dreams of going to school, had saved money to go to college, and that money was taken away from her and given to her brother because she was told that it was a waste of money to educate a black girl. And she never forgot that. And she didn't want me to forget that. She wanted me to remember, no matter how bad my circumstances were, that I can make a better life for myself. And she made a challenge for me when I got off that bus, and it made me start thinking about what my life could be and what I could achieve.
What did your mother do when you're living with your grandmother, your brother sent to foster care? What happened to your mom?
She actually ended up marrying my stepdad, who had been a volunteer at the soup kitchen that we were at, and that provided some level of stability for her. And again, I'm thankful for that. Mm-hmm. At one point, I was sent to go back and live with her for about a year, and it was a great year. But again, she wasn't very stable, and we ended up homeless again. So I was sent back to go live with my grandmother.
Sometimes it's said about children when they see that their parents are struggling or in trouble, that children feel a sense of responsibility or obligation to help them or perhaps even save them. As a little girl, did you feel that way about your mom?
Absolutely. And I felt like a burden. I felt like maybe if I wasn't there, she could, you know, maybe she could have done better. You know, one of the decisions that I made before I even went to live with my grandmother is I remember waking up in a motel and knowing it was the last day that we had money to be there and that we were going to have to check out. And I remember my mom being passed out and my little brother being there. And I said, "I'm not going to live like this. When I'm an adult, I'm not going to live like this." And I pulled out a phone book and started calling places to see if they would take us. And some of them hung up on me because I was a little kid and they thought I was crank calling them. But then I found a place that was willing to take us. But I'm here because people invested in me, and not just my grandmother, but when I went to the senior citizen complex she was living in, it was very diverse and multicultural, but it wasn't set up for children. Like, people were grandparents and they could have their grandchildren visit. So what would happen is when the landlord would come, everyone in the complex would claim me. So one week I would have a Hispanic grandmother, another week I would have an Asian grandmother. So literally one week I was Nikki Wong, and everybody pretended that they, which is kind of funny as an African American, but
well, you never know, right?
You never know. These days with modern family, you really never know. But it was a wonderful thing.
Did you have teachers that saw your gifts, your skills, your light?
Yes. I was fortunate enough to be put into, and you'll hear me say that I was fortunate because I know that that's part of it. I did work hard, but part of it is luck and fortune. There were teachers who saw that I was smart and really tried to keep it going. I really loved to read, and that really came from the library. It's something that I love to do now. I'm a voracious reader. I can sit down and read a book in an entire day.
Wow.
And so they definitely encouraged me, but it's very hard when your home life isn't as stable. And I moved around a lot, but I think it was a combination of teachers seeing something great in me, but also me being willing to accept help. And I think that's hard to do.
To accept help?
Yes.
Because it means you need help.
Yes, but being on the streets, asking for help can be seen as a weakness.
Sure.
And when you live in certain neighborhoods, any type of weakness can make you a victim. And so you do anything to not be a victim. But that mentality actually played against me as I got older, because when I went to St. Joe's and had some difficulties, I didn't ask for help. And that's equally as important as asking for help, and it's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength.
I do want to talk about your time at St. Joe's and obviously the other parts of your life, but I'm also curious, because we have homeless people here in Philadelphia, I pass them every day. Some of them I talk to, some of them I give money to, many of them I don't. As a little girl with a family, did you beg on the streets? Did you ask for money? Were you put in that situation?
We tried not to, but sometimes we did. The thing that I remember now is that people ignored us. It's like you're invisible. People, I think it causes people fear, and there's certainly an element of blaming the victim that you must have done something wrong. And yes, my mother didn't make great decisions, but I do think we have to ask ourselves as a society, who do we want to be? Just because people make bad decisions, do we not think that people deserve to have a roof over their head or food in their stomach? And I'm saying that as somebody who was hungry. But I understand where that comes from, because I don't necessarily give people money on the streets. I do a lot of advocacy. I'm a member of Project Homes Board of Trustees, so that's how I give.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Nikki Johnson Houston. She is currently an assistant city solicitor for the City of Philadelphia's Law Department. We are talking about how she got from there to here, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Woodmere Art Museum in Chestnut Hill supports WHYY and offers a variety of art classes and workshops for all ages and skill levels. Art making with classes for adults that include painting, watercolor, drawing, collage, mosaics, and Zentangle. Children and teens ages 6 and up can enjoy printmaking, painting, animation, sculpture, and more. All classes taught by renowned local artists. Parking is available. For more information, 215-247-0948 or woodmereartmuseum.org.
What is Hanukkah? If the answer doesn't exactly leap to mind with the speed of a spinning dreidel,
then tune in for Candles Burning Brightly. I'm Mindy Ratner.
And I'm Bill Morlock. Join us as we listen to the music, light the candles, and eat the food of Hanukkah.
Candles Burning Brightly, a celebration of Hanukkah.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
Nigeria's Wole Soyinka was the first black African to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's been writing about Africa for decades, but his love for the continent is not blind.
This is not really the stage of development that we should be after over half a century of independence.
Wole Soyinka is with us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Nikki Johnson-Houston about her life. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You wrote a piece on Huffington Post about your life. And in that piece, you say about your grandmother, she was the greatest person you've ever known.
Absolutely. I think my grandmother is a wonderful example of a generation, especially of Black women, who work so hard for their families. And she sacrificed for me, and she sacrificed for her children, even knowing that she may not get the benefits of all of that. And she taught me so much about service, because one of the things that she said to me is, I believe that you can do something great in this world. But she said, your greatness isn't going to be just in what you achieve, but in what you help other people to achieve. And just the guidance and the kindness that she showed to me, it wasn't just that she took me in. She mentored me and guided me, even when she didn't have a lot of education herself, and I wouldn't be the woman that I am without her. And she had a dignity and a pride to her. One of the things that she used to say to me was that there was no shame in being poor, but being poor of character, and that I should always hold my head up high, but that I had an obligation to be the best person that I could be.
Did she say those same things to your mom? I mean, she's your mom's mom, right?
Yes.
Your maternal grandmother. Did she say those same things to her?
I don't know if she said them in the same way. I mean, I always think that there's a difference between being a grandparent and being a parent. And I think she was trying to raise five children by herself, you know, going, you know, she taught herself how to cook and went to school and was working as a domestic and put them through Catholic schools. And I think my grandmother was very much old school of, I show you I love you, not necessarily I'll tell you I love you. And I think as she got older, she realized that also telling you that she loved you was just as important. I think they had a different relationship. But I also think I was fortunate enough that she only had to be responsible for me. And for somebody to be disabled in their late 60s, to be willing to take on a grandchild, I mean, she could have said, I can't do it. And I'll always be grateful for that.
Sounds like you were a good girl, too.
I tried to be.
in the best sense.
Yes, I tried to be. I didn't do my chores as well as I could have. But other than that, I was a pretty good girl.
And she would remind you of that.
Yes, she would.
Your brother, as you said, was actually ended up in foster care.
Yes,
and ended up in a very different situation from you, and frankly very sad to read about him. As you wrote, he dropped out of school, he got HIV, he was addicted to drugs, and unfortunately a couple of years ago tried to kill himself.
Yes. I got a call on my way to work that my brother had hung himself in court-ordered rehab, but that he hadn't died, he was on life support, and that I needed to get to California as quickly as I can. And I flew out and flew my mother and my stepdad out, and I had to take my baby brother off life support. And I was so angry in that moment. I felt like I'd done everything right. I was angry at God. I didn't understand why this had happened to my family. But I think very quickly I understood that my brother made choices that weren't great choices. And he felt like he didn't have a lot of choices in life. But I realized that I wanted his life to mean something more than just sort of being this tragedy, and that I wanted to do something positive out of it. So I'd already been going around and speaking and doing mentoring. But one of the things is at first I felt so bad about what happened with my brother, but I actually ended up having a memorial service for him at the rehab center where he was being treated. And as we were driving, we saw all of these ragtag people like walking down the street. And I'm like, where are they going? And it turns out they were coming for my brother.
Wow.
It was about 75 people. And we came together and people sang and they read poems that they wrote and told me things about my brother that I didn't know, that at one point he had been clean and that he had been a volunteer there and that he had helped them when they were going through it. And one person said, I'll never forget, I was at my lowest point, and he hugged me and said, this too shall pass. And it helps me to see that my brother was a full person and that he had these difficulties in life, but that he was a kind person and that he was important to people. And it was very hard because we were separated for so long that, as you can imagine, that put such a wall between us.
Sure. I wonder, too, and you don't want to make too much of the fact, but the fact that you had this grandmother who was so involved in your life and who was giving you guidance, and it sounds like perhaps some tough love, but clearly some love.
Yes.
I don't know what his life was like in foster care. I know that can be difficult. Do you think that helps explain a little bit about your life and his life?
Yes. I mean, it was absolutely very difficult. He didn't necessarily have the support. He didn't, there wasn't somebody who was telling him, you can do something great with your life. So, absolutely. And I think he really missed and never recovered from the fact that we didn't live with our mother. He always mourned that. And I think I was just a much more resilient kind of person. Mm-hmm. I just would adapt to whatever situation that I was in. And Michael was much more sensitive. He was much more, I like to tell people, the sad thing is that my brother was way more talented than I am. Absolutely.
You mean that?
Yes, absolutely. But he couldn't get to that place. And I tried to help him, but what I learned from that is how I was trying to help him was like, you should go back to school and you should make better choices. And that it wasn't that it was bad advice. It just was my brother wasn't in a place to hear that. And that's something that I'll always regret. And now when I go and speak to people, my mantra is I take people where they are. And I cannot fix their life, but I try to help them see the possibilities in their own life and to get them to a place where they can see what's possible and to try to support them along their journey. But I can't want it more than they want it. So it's about giving someone really a hand up and that support, trying to be that support system. But I do believe that most people have inside of them the things that they need to succeed. It's just being able to see if it's possible, that belief.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Nikki Johnson-Houston, our guest today on Radio Times. She's currently an assistant city solicitor for the City of Philadelphia's Law Department. She was named among the best advocates of 40 lawyers under the age of 40 by the National Bar Association. She's a 2012 USA Eisenhower Fellow. In fact, just got back from a trip to India and New Zealand to study poverty and homelessness, something that she knows about very personally as a child growing up in Detroit and then California. She's joining us today on Radio Times, frankly, to talk about her life. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So clearly you were a good student. You end up at St. Joseph's University, which is just outside of Philadelphia. This is your freshman year, and I'm sure full of all sorts of expectations about what college was going to offer. What happened?
St. Joe's was wonderful. It seemed like a dream. I got off the plane and it's leafy and gorgeous and small and private, and the people were lovely there. I think for me, I didn't understand what college would really be like. I think academically I was prepared, but I think emotionally I wasn't prepared to go into an environment where people were so different from me.
Culture shock of some sort.
I really had culture shock, and I didn't know how to ask for help. And I was homesick, and I was so far away from anything that I knew. I felt like everything about me wasn't right. I didn't have a winter coat. I didn't know not to wear right after Labor Day. I didn't sort of speak the language. And it wasn't because people weren't nice to me, because they were. But a lot of people didn't sort of know what my background was. And I think a lot of schools now are sort of starting, and I know St. Joe's does this because they brought me back to sort of speak about my experience. I think a lot of schools now are giving kids the support. So what a lot of colleges are doing is they're bringing disadvantaged students in earlier in the summer to sort of get acclimated. They're putting them together with a mentor. They're giving them an advisor to sort of deal with those issues. And I think it wasn't sort of as common back then, but a lot of it was my own poor decision-making. I started not going to class. I felt like I wasn't good enough. I felt like I was a fraud and didn't deserve to be there, and that everybody could see that. And, you know, it's hard sort of not having that support, because there were a lot of affluent people there, and so their context of their life was very different than mine.
And you must have felt very different from them.
I did. I felt very different from them. But that was more of my own making. But I think that comes from being young, and you get a little bit of maturity. And so all of those things led to me, my first semester, being put on academic probation. But instead of sort of spurring me on to do better, it almost froze me. And so I just couldn't get out of my own way. So I understand what that feels like for people. And I ended up being kicked out. So I'm in Philadelphia. My grandmother's in California. I don't really know anybody, and I have to figure out what I'm going to do.
You end up being a nanny for a couple on the main line.
Yes. Deborah Levy and Donald Versoff, and I hope they're listening. they were a lifesaver for me. My childhood dream had always been to be a lawyer, and I answered an ad for a live-in nanny and didn't really have a lot of experience, and they took a chance on me, and they just both happened to be lawyers. So what are the odds of that? And you know, I was in this difficult place in my life, but they were also people who helped me believe that I could do something great. I mean, Don was a professor at Villanova, and he said, I think you're bright. I think you could go to law school and that you could be successful. And Deborah, even though she's not old enough to be my mom, she really did take on that role of being like a second mother to me. And their support, and also being able to model and see sort of how they lived, was very important to me. And that,
a very middle class life, I would think, or a professional middle class life.
Very professional middle class life, right. Lovely, lovely family, lovely child. And that was 18 years ago. We actually just celebrated our 18th anniversary this summer. And Ben is now 21. He was 3 when I came, and he will be graduating from Emory in May, and I'm actually going to go. And it's amazing. Ben said to me last year, because he comes down to my office to visit me when he's here and we have lunch, he said, I can't believe that you were younger than I am now, and you were taking care of a 3-year-old. And I said, but you were a really great 3-year-old. And so I started going back to school at night.
So why did you, or when did you want to be a lawyer? Is that something you've always wanted in your life?
I always wanted to be a lawyer. I guess growing up with my grandmother, I was watching black and white Perry Mason and then Matlock.
There you go.
And then Bill Cosby comes on with The Cosby Show, and there's Claire Huxtable. And I knew that was who I wanted to be. And you want to know how life goes full circle? I had an opportunity to do a speaking engagement with Bill Cosby at Temple about 4 years ago. And I was telling him this story, and he said, and now you're the real life Claire Huxtable. And I could have just died and gone to heaven right there.
But what's interesting is you go to Temple University Law School, not just for one degree. You have 3 degrees, a JD, an MBA, and a master's in tax law.
Yes.
You were, what, in a big hurry? You wanted to just get all this done at once?
That was not the plan originally. The plan originally was I went there to go to law school, and I was happy and thrilled to be there. But they gave me an opportunity. I'd always wanted to get an MBA. And during my second semester, they said, you know, we have this JD MBA program, and if you can do well enough on your GMATs, you can get your MBA for free. Right. You just have to pay your law school tuition. And I was like, fantastic. Whoa. So I took it. I took the GMAT cold, got a good enough score to be able to get into the MBA program. And then actually how I ended up doing the master's in tax at the same time was I would have run out of financial aid, and I would have graduated in the middle of the year. And so I took a couple of tax classes, and I ended up really liking tax. I know that's not something that most people would think is that exciting. And then I said, well, you know what? What about this? And it took a few months to get permission to do that, because it wasn't something that they had commonly done, and they wanted to make sure that I was successful and that I was there to get a law degree, so that no matter what happened, that I would get my law degree. But they were very supportive, and this time I had no problem asking for help when I needed it. And I'm really grateful that I was able to do something that sort of was special and different. And I always like to say, not bad for a girl who failed out of college. It really is where – it's not where you start. It's really where you end.
Well, you've said some very interesting things during this hour. You've also said some other things that I've read about that are they're equally as interesting, and some about poverty, some about possibilities. I mean, what I hear from your story is that while there were barriers, there were obstacles, there were problems you had to deal with, there always seemed to be this sense of a different life or a possibility somewhere.
Absolutely. I mean, I didn't necessarily know that things would turn out the way that they did. I mean, it's turned out better than I really could have imagined. But I knew what my life would look like if I didn't do something different. And I didn't know all of this would be the way it would be, but I knew it had to be better than how I grew up. And I was going to give it my best shot. I wasn't going to fail. I couldn't afford to fail. And I really think that sort of resilience and grittiness I absolutely got from my grandmother, because she was just one of those you get it done kind of people. And she never made me feel that if I failed, that I was a failure. And I think that's really what I took away from it. So even though I did fail out of college, I did believe that it was a possibility for me to go back. And it's one of the things that I talk about a lot when I go and speak to children, because it's actually something that I didn't realize at the time. It's actually something that happens on a fairly regular basis with kids who are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds, and they're going to school, but they don't have a lot of support, and there's a lot of family responsibilities that come along with that. So even when I was in school and working at night, I would send money to my mother and my stepdad, not always on a regular basis, but I would get a call saying I'm about to be put on the streets, and I would put hotels on my credit cards. And so that's the reality when you're coming from that disadvantaged background. And a lot of people have to stop school so they can work to support not only their parents, but sometimes younger siblings or cousins.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again. Nikki Johnson Houston, our guest today on Radio Time. She currently works as an assistant city solicitor here in the city of Philadelphia. We're talking about, frankly, her life, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. In fact, we'll take some calls after this very short break. Much more to talk about, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Handel's inspiring Messiah has become as integral to the American holiday season as Dickens' A Christmas Carol or the film It's a Wonderful Life. The Philadelphia Orchestra performing Handel's Messiah. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. Sunday, December 23rd at 2 p.m., one performance only at the Kimmel Center. The Philadelphia Orchestra presents Handel's Messiah.
On the next Fresh Air, David Nassau talks about his biography of Joseph Kennedy, the patriarch. Even after his sons, Jack and Bobby, were president and attorney general, they still turned to their influential father. During the Bay of Pigs crisis, the brothers were in the Oval Office.
And Bobby says to Jack, "Let's call Dad, he'll make us feel better."
Join us. this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Whether you're 20-something or inching close to retirement, we'll look at saving and investing with John Bogle, founder of the mutual fund giant The Vanguard Group. Also, the latest on the violence in Syria. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and our guest Nikki Johnson-Houston has been telling us about her life, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me just finish another piece of your story, which is that you just got back from a trip to India, New Zealand. You're a 2012 USA Eisenhower Fellow. Went there to study, I guess, poverty and homelessness. Was that your choice to... because of your life?
Yes, absolutely. The Eisenhower Fellowship gives emerging leaders an opportunity to travel around the world and study a policy issue that's important to you. So they picked me, and they also picked my project. One of the reasons I picked India was because it's the world's largest democracy, and sort of everyone's talking so much about the growing middle class there. But I really wanted to know, well, what's happening to everyone else? Is sort of some of this prosperity trickling down to other people? And I also had an understanding that there wasn't a social safety net in the same way that there is in the United States. And I wanted to see, how did that work? And New Zealand was the other side of the coin because they have a very extensive social safety net. In fact, they consider themselves socialist.
Right.
So I wanted to see, with this extensive social safety net, did they have better outcomes than we do in the United States?
So what was your conclusion?
And
I realize that's not a, there's not a simple answer to this.
I thought the people in New Zealand were lovely, and they have a very generous social safety net. I think there's two issues that they're dealing with now. One is it's a small country, so there's only about 4 million people. So they're having difficulty in being able to continue to pay for it. But the other issue is that they have a real issue with generational poverty. So because the benefits are so generous, there's almost a disincentive to work. And I think you have to have a balance. Mm. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the social safety net, which my grandmother raised me on. Food stamps. She raised me on welfare, subsidized housing. So I needed those things. But the way the system is set up, it's supposed to be to help you as long as you need it. But since I've been 18 years old, and there have been times I didn't have a lot of money and was eating top ramen soup, I've been self-sufficient. And I like to say that the taxpayers invested in me, and that in an ideal world, that's the way it's supposed to work. It's not supposed to be generational. There's dignity in work, and you don't want to take that away from people, but you also need to balance that with helping people who need help. It really is. India was sort of the opposite, which was they didn't have a social safety net really at all. The expectation is that your extended family would take care of you. But people who didn't have an extended family or didn't have the resources or they just weren't interested were ending out on the street. You'd see a lot of young children who were begging, who'd been sold. And it wasn't because these people didn't work. They work a lot, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, but they weren't making a living wage. Mm. And they have intact families. They don't have a lot of children born out of wedlock there. So a lot of the traditional issues of what we think leads to poverty in the United States, they didn't have those in India. But what I came out with is I'd rather live in a country that arguably gives too much to its people than doesn't give enough. But I really admired the Indian values of family and education, because I hardly needed a translator in India because almost everyone spoke English, even in the slums, because English was currency. It meant that you had the ability to be able to move around And honestly, I wasn't sure how they would accept me in India, but they really embraced my story. To them, I was a former street kid who did well and got educated and sort of is living the dream. And what I realized is that poverty doesn't discriminate. It doesn't have a color or a gender or a nationality. And that as long as people are suffering anywhere in the world, that matters. And so it gave me much more of a global perspective. And I wasn't sure how I would be received when I got there, but they really identified with my story. And Black Americans sort of our historical place in the United States, especially like the scheduled caste, who are like the untouchables and the lower caste, they really identified with that, and they actually knew a lot about our history. So it was fascinating.
Well, let's get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Seidel from Conshohocken joining us on Radio Times. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nikki, yours is clearly an extraordinary story, and your self-determination helped to pull you through. But along the way, as you explain, individuals helped you, guided you, supported you, and the social safety net was there for your grandmother, provided her with decent, affordable housing, provided food stamps to put food on the table. So my question for you is, what can caring people do to help children who are in situations similar to the one that you were in? What can we do one-on-one, and what can we do in an advocacy role to help preserve the safety net, the social safety net? And I'll take the answer off the air.
Seidel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Nikki, go ahead.
That's a really great question. I would say on an individual basis is mentoring. I mean, I think a lot of us do come across people in our life that we see who need help. And I think sort of taking on that responsibility of saying, you know what, I'm not going to wait for the next person. I'm going to reach out. But it's a two-way street. Yes, people were willing to help me, but I also needed to be in a place where I could accept that. And in some places in my life, I was more willing to do that than others. But mentoring is huge. I personally mentor a lot of not just kids, but adults. I think being able to talk to someone about the difficulties that you're going through, to be able to model. In terms of advocacy, I mean, I think it's important to get involved and know what's going on in your communities, to advocate for not just the social safety net, but schools, having decent schools. I mean, it wasn't just that I had a social safety net. I went to decent schools. I was able to be in advanced programs and gifted programs, and those things were available to me. So even though I was poor, I did have a pretty good, my fundamentals of my education were strong, so that when I went to college, even though I did fail out, it wasn't because it was more of the emotional things. It really wasn't because I didn't have the skills.
Seidel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Did your grandmother live long enough to know that you graduated from Temple University with a law degree?
No. She died when I was a junior in college, but I was back in school, and the last weekend I spent with her was Mother's Day weekend, and she said to me, it's like she knew she was going to pass away. She's like, I'm just so incredibly proud of the woman you turned out to be.
Wow.
And that there's no higher praise than that. But the point is for me to pass it forward.
Do you miss her?
I do. Every day. And when really great things like this happen to me, I wish that she could be here. But I believe that she is, and the way that I honor her is talking about these issues that are important to me.
Let me see what Carly has to say. Carly from Fishtown joining us today on Radio Times. Hi, Carly. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm an avid listener of Radio Times, and I just wanted to thank Nikki so much for talking about these things. I feel like she's kind of telling my life story right now.
Interesting.
I was actually taken from my parents by the time I was 8 years old and lived with my grandparents, and you know, they became the parental guardians for me, and they were able to give me a life that my parents couldn't give me because they were both drug addicts, and I was able to go to boarding school and on to college and finishing my degree in, at Tyler School of Art from Temple University.
As another Temple person.
Jewelry design. And I feel that it's really important also to pay it forward, and I have a mentoring facility where I teach people how to make jewelry, and I just think it's really great. And I also just wanted to give my condolences for you and having to, take your brother off life support. I had to go through the same thing with my mom 2 years ago, so I really
thank you for sharing
this whole conversation.
Thank you for sharing your story.
Absolutely, Carly. Thank you for calling into Radio Times, because you have a parallel, very interesting, very similar story to tell.
And I think there's thousands and millions of people who do. There's a lot of grandparents that are stepping up, that are taking responsibility for children. It's actually becoming very common. I think we also have to make sure that the safety net is in place to allow them to be able to provide that life for the children. Like I said, the taxpayers invested in me, and if as talented as I think I was, and even with the mentoring, being able to borrow student loans to be able to go back to school made a difference for me. I wouldn't be here without those things. I do think, though, that there is an understanding that the system can't continue in quite the way that it is now. So we need to work on making it more efficient and more effective. And I'd like to see, some of the programs tied more to doing positive things. So I think we want to encourage people to not only go to college, but to get skills. That was one of the things that I saw in India, was that they weren't teaching everybody to go to four-year schools, because it's not for everyone. Everyone doesn't have an interest, but they really focused on skills. And that's sort of where the United States is really going to have some difficulty if we don't start thinking outside of the box. Community college, trade schools, really learning really significant skill sets.
Carly, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You added a lot to the show as well. I'm curious, Nikki, about where your mother is today. Do you know?
Yes, I do. The last couple of years has been very tough. I have to say that the death of my brother sort of fractured the remainder of that relationship. Mm-hmm. I think because he passed away, I blamed her for that. And I think I've sort of moved past that a little bit and realized that my brother was a grown-up, and he made choices, and, I did reach out and try to help him, and he wasn't there. And I know my mom did the best that she could, and it just wasn't good enough. That's the reality of it. So actually, this past Thanksgiving, we just started opening up the lines.
Really? By talking, emailing?
Of communication. We spoke to each other, and I think I have to forgive her, not even just for herself, but for me. And I think she did the best that she could, given the circumstances. And I think if now that I'm an adult, I just realize that it's so much more complicated than you realize. And I'm just glad that she didn't try to keep us, and I might have ended up in a much worse situation. So it was selfless what she did by sending me to my grandmother, and I'll always be thankful for that.
Do you feel like a survivor? Do you feel like a survivor?
A little bit, but, I'm not a victim. I'm not someone that I want anybody to feel sorry for. I think I'm a lucky person. I think I'm an accomplished person. I'm living the kind of life that I always wanted to live. So I'm thinking beyond that. I'm thinking about what the next thing is. And, I don't know if I'll turn out to even be a great person, but maybe one of the kids that I speak to, or one of the adults that I speak to, maybe they'll go on to do something great. And that's good enough for me, because I'm living my dream of being a lawyer. That's really what I wanted for myself. And now that dream has expanded to advocacy.
One of the things that I read that you wrote about poverty, that one way to think about poverty is as a disease, or it can be, I guess it can be a disease for some people.
Yes, because it's like a disease. It can be passed on to family members. But like any disease, if you treat it or if you pre-treat it, you can eradicate it. And it's not something that's a foregone conclusion. And I think I want people to hear my story. And when you walk past that kid on the sidewalk or somebody who maybe hasn't made great decisions, to think, hey, maybe it's possible. Because now people are saying, wow, she's doing really great. But I wasn't always the person that I am now. I was the kid who'd bailed out, and a lot of people wrote me off, but I never wrote myself off, and Don and Deborah didn't write me off, and my grandmother didn't write me off, and I needed all of those things for me to make it.
So what do you love so much about tax law?
What do I love so much about
in
tax law?
40 seconds or less.
Well, I can tell you what I love about my job.
Okay.
What I love about my job is that I get to represent the citizens of Philadelphia, and some days I get to do just the right thing. And I don't think you can ask for more than that from your job.
Well, on that note, Nikki Johnson-Houston, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We have actually, we can't take her, Alice from Morrisville, one of your professors on the line. Couldn't take the call, but she says she's very proud of you.
Oh, Professor Abreu, hi. Oh, and I want to say hello to my gentleman from St. Elizabeth's at the homeless shelter. We had a good time dancing last night at the Project Home holiday party.
Oh, wow. Well, Nikki Johnson-Houston, again, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. And she is an assistant city solicitor for the City of Philadelphia's Law Department and a 2012 USA Eisenhower Fellow. Just got back from a trip to India and New Zealand. Again, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. We had assistance today from Emily Bryant. Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, it's Here and Now. Tomorrow in the first hour of Radio Times, we'll be talking